state receives on its general obligation bonds compare with other states' general obligation bonds. We found that the state does very well, does better than other AA-rated credits in the lower 48. And that's something that you should be very proud of. You have a very strong and secure AA rating, and it's viewed very highly by investors in the lower 48. There have been a number of, that has been cultivated and worked on. That's not just a result of chance. I think that the Department of Revenue and the people who manage the state's debt are in large part to be thanked for that. And it's large in part to the steps that they've taken over the years that have given the state the high degree of creditworthiness. Some indicators that we use to measure how well the state performs are, it has a very broad institutional appeal among investors. Very sophisticated, knowledgeable investors are largely the ones that are purchasing a major share of the state's general obligation bonds. The bonds are not in major part being bought by individuals. And that says a lot for two reasons. One, that the cost of marketing bonds to an institution are less than marketing bonds to an individual. So you pay lower borrowing costs in that respect. And it also means that you're thought of very highly by the major financial institutions. You have lower underwriting spreads as a result of that than other states in the lower 48. You're paying lower interest in terms of reoffering yields at 5 and 10 year levels than other states are. So all those add up to a very strong and strong security, and it's something to be very proud of, and it's something to try to preserve as well.
Senator Josephson.
Thank you. We ought to credit the good Lord to putting the oil in the ground.
Right.
But as we look to the decline in the throughput on the pipeline as the crude oil field winds down, are we going to have to go to shorter and shorter duration on these bonds? Is that one answer?
Yes. I think so. I'm not really, there may be other people that you could ask that question of this afternoon, but I think that it's important. Investors are not going to purchase bonds that have maturities in years in which there is not a known and predictable source of revenues to repay those bonds. And to the extent that the Department of Revenue's revenue projections are have a downward trend or even are uncertain, I think that, yes, you'll have to issue debt with either shorter maturities or in not as large principal amounts so that you'll be able to pay off the debt service in those 10 years.
That would mean that we're going to be getting an annual impact of that in our budgets very soon, because we cannot extend it, we cannot amortize over the longer period at these interest rates.
4-year bonds?
That may be if indeed the revenue projections, the revenues are not projected to be there in those out years, that's true. The bond market and the investment community place a great deal of strength on the revenue projections by the Department of Revenue. They thought of this being very sophisticated, and I think that it's your own shop that's calling the shots there. You're making the projections and I don't think anyone's going to come up and say we disagree with you that revenues aren't going to be there in 5 years, whereas you're projecting them in 10. But I do think that as it's very important that you tailor your maturity structure then and the payment of debt service to the ability to repay those obligations. That's the first step in credit analysis, and that's what anyone will tell you in New York, is that if you don't think you're going to have the money out there, you're not going to be able to sell the bonds unless it's at very high interest rates.
Go ahead and continue. I think what we're going to try to do, at least for the audience, is plan to let you continue up through. If we go till 12, that's fine. I think we're going to have a set of more questions coming from the audience. And then this afternoon, if we could take Perry Davis and Terry Elder, if they would yield to this afternoon and testimony during that time. Depending on how fast we go here, but I don't want to overload it here.
I'm going to move right into the recommended changes in the state debt management. The first one, we suggested an expanded role for the State Bond Committee. Now, this takes on several major responsibilities. The first is to oversee all state-level borrowing. Rather than the State Bond Committee, it appeared to us, has been primarily concerned with the state's own general obligation bonds and those bonds issued by the International Airport Authority, those are the only borrowing programs which they are given the responsibility in the legislation, by the legislature to perform. So we're not recommending approval of agency borrowing, but evaluation of all outstanding obligations of the state, to advise the executive branch and the legislature of the impacts on the state's creditworthiness of the various borrowing programs, and to pay a special attention to all the contingent liabilities, those moral obligation bonds and the general obligation bonds issued by HFC. Again, it's not an approval but it's an oversight, and I think that one example of why that oversight is important is, as it relates to the general obligation bonds of AHFC, is the state of Oregon's experience with veterans housing bonds. They have issued general obligation veterans housing bonds for many years, for at least the last 10 years. They've been issuing bonds very similar to those that AHFC has just started issuing. They've done it at much higher levels than AHFC has. They have over $5 billion right now in mortgage bonds outstanding, which the state has its general obligation pledged to pay off. The state of Oregon was downgraded in July of 1980 from a AAA state to a AA. Now, a large part of that was just due to economic conditions in the Northwest that affected many borrowers. However, another significant item in the credit analyst's opinion was the growth in contingent liabilities, meaning the growth in issuance of general obligation bonds that were really self-supporting. They were self-supporting in the first instance, but they were still contingent liabilities on the state. So I think the growth in contingent liabilities does, while it's unquantifiable, and we make that point in the report, that there's no measure for when a contingent liability is too much. It is really incumbent upon the State Bond Committee, its advisors, to just test the market, to see what the credit rating agencies and what others in the investment community are willing where the breaking point is, when a contingent liability becomes so significant a factor in analysis of credit worthiness that it severely impacts that. And it appears to have done that in the state of Oregon. Now, we did not sense that there's any danger at this point in that occurring in Alaska. That it's not felt that the contingent liabilities upon the state are too great. But it does require at least someone in the state with a responsibility for looking into that and for ascertaining when a contingent liability may be too great. And that's really the major role that we see the State Bond Committee performing, is getting a handle on all state debt issuance and the use of the contingent liability forms of security. Now, in the case of a moral obligation bond, we recommended that the State Bond Committee be an independent assessor of an individual project's financial capability to pay off the bonds. And I think a good case for this is the Alaska Power Authority. If the Power Authority intends to issue further project revenue bonds or system revenue bonds, the difference between a project revenue bond and a system revenue bond is that either the revenues from a specific project are pledged to repay the bonds, or those bonds have a lien on the total system revenues. In either case, if those bonds carry a moral obligation, it represents a contingent liability of the state. And I think that there should be someone in the state who evaluates the financial projections of the Power Authority and to ascertain whether it is a good idea for the state to take the risk that those bonds might ultimately land up in the state's lap. It requires just looking into what their the state should know what risk it's getting into if it's putting up its moral obligation. It should at least know how sensitive the project is to various financial assumptions and other things of that sort. The state should have someone who's looking into the project's financial capabilities as well as the independent agency if the state is going to back up the bonds. It makes sense. And I think something you might want to ask yourselves is, what if the system revenue bonds that have been issued by the Washington Public Power Supply System had a moral obligation behind them? They don't, and I'm sure Governor Spellman and others are very, and the legislature is very thankful that there is no moral obligation. But had those bonds been issued by the Alaska Power Authority, they would have a moral obligation behind them just by the nature that they had been issued by the APA, and the legislature would be in a difficult situation. Another recommendation that we had for the expanded role that the State Bond Committee plays would be to collect debt issuance plans from the individual state agencies, from AHSC, from the APA, just to ask them, what are you planning on doing over the next year? I know, AHSC and others have an appropriation, a maximum bonded indebtedness that they can issue each year that the legislature establishes. However, there are two problems with that. One is that you don't know whether or not they intend to issue all that debt, and two, you don't know when that debt is going to be issued. And both of those factors influence the marketability and the market timing of the state's own obligations and the obligations of other state agencies and municipalities. Because the bond market, like many markets, is dependent on supply and demand, excess supply causes prices to go up. Can cause excess supply of bonds can mean that the prices of those bonds goes up, and the interest cost to the investor, the price to the investor goes down, but the interest cost to the investor goes up, to the issuer goes up. So it's important that, in order to get the lowest interest costs, that the volume of bonds that are issued by any one jurisdiction or from any one state be fairly levelized. You don't want massive amounts of debt to be issued by AHFC and the state and other agencies during any one month, for instance. And for that reason, it would help the state in its own debt planning, and it would help other issuers in the state to know what everyone else is doing. It's called a bond calendar. And many states maintain what is called a bond calendar, which every year or every month or every quarter they send to all the issuers the projected issuances from each agency over the next quarter or year, whatever time period is chosen. And that it permits everybody to plan their debt issuance. And it treats everyone fairly. As it stands now, you kind of jump into the market whenever you see a window opening up. As you see interest rates going down, everyone wants to take advantage of lower interest rates. And so there's generally a trend to try to take advantage of that by a variety of issuers. And oftentimes, it's the larger issuers who really win out in that case. And it might be a good idea for some sort of coordination to take place through a bond calendar, or just so that some central point in the state is informed of what everyone else is planning on doing. You're not requiring anyone to do that, but you just have a better idea of what debt's going to be issued, and that would help the State Bond Committee, especially in planning its own debt issuances.
Just a quick question, and then I'm going to go over to Senator Josephson. Now, historically, then, do you know of any particular problems we've had in the past where we've had an overlap of, let's say, municipal bonds with AHFC bonds or general obligation bonds, and that overlap has actually hurt us in the market from a standpoint of the interest cost to those particular bonds? And I'd like to know if there were any particular cases that you know historically in the state of Alaska since they started issuing bonds that would have impacted our credit rating or would have impacted the actual interest rate that we went to the market for those bonds. Mm-hmm. Because I think coordination is what we're talking about here, and if we can coordinate our efforts statewide, we can do well.
I'm not familiar with any particular instance. I think there might be people this afternoon that you could ask that question of. who are more familiar with the actual marketing of the state's bonds. I am familiar, I did, however, in talking with the finance director of the municipality of Anchorage, he did comment that there was a particular issue of his several years ago, which had been planned by Anchorage. It's very difficult for me. This is an issue of where the state bumps up against the municipalities' debt issuance. Municipalities typically issue general obligation bonds through a competitive sale, which means that they receive bids for those bonds, and the underwriting firm or syndicate of firms which submits the bid with the it results in the lowest interest cost to the issuer is the one who wins that bond sale. Well, because of the nature of a competitive bond sale, you have to plan that bond sale and notify all prospective bidders weeks in advance. Generally, at least three weeks is good. You can do it, but 3 weeks is what's generally recommended. Well, revenue bonds are often negotiated, which means that there's no need to notify prospective bidders weeks in advance. You jump in when you think the market is ripe. Well, that can cause a problem for, say, the municipality of Anchorage, which plans in 3 weeks to issue bonds, and suddenly finds in 3 weeks' time that AHFC is planning on issuing bonds that same day or the next day. And it's difficult to measure how that affects Anchorage. Some people would tell you that it doesn't affect them at all because the market for the debt is different, because the AHFC sells debt to institutions and Anchorage sells debt to largely to individuals, and therefore there's no effect. Well, that may be true, but it's probably true that there probably is some interest effect that is borne by Anchorage and probably not by AHFC. So a coordinated calendar would have helped. This was a particular case that was given to me by municipality of Anchorage, but it would have helped him in planning his debt issuance if he had known that AHFC was planning on going to market that week.
Thank you, Senator Josephson. If you'd like to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Because I won't be here this afternoon, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for allowing me to participate in I've been asked to ask you this regarding AHFC. You've indicated that there is the category of direct debt and the indirect debt, which has the moral obligation feature. Let me ask you about the concept of an unwritten moral obligation, as in the case of AHFC financing, where the agency bears Alaska's name, but no moral obligation feature is authorized. Would a default situation in that case be damaging to the credit rating of the state if the state did not come to the rescue of the borrowing entity, even though no moral obligation is expressed?
You are right. There's, in all instances, but any debt that is issued by the state within the confines of the state's boundaries, that's not only by state agencies but also by municipalities, bears a political obligation to be repaid by the state. In the case of a moral obligation, that's a legal, it's a political legal obligation. It's in a little gray zone. But all debt issued by the state would bear a political obligation to be ultimately repaid by the legislature.
You may not be the one to ask this, but are there instances in which the state itself is held liable even without a moral obligation feature or general obligation feature on some kind of equitable basis or the basis of holding out because executive personnel of the state are board members of the issuing agency or otherwise involved in politics?
I don't know. That makes a much stronger case, you're right, for the state acting upon its political obligation when you have such an interlocking nature of boards of directors. I can't speak to the legal obligation. In the event that such a default did occur and the state did not act upon this, I think it would be looked upon as a negative factor in evaluating the state's credit and of other agencies within the state. However, again, it's very difficult to ascertain how long that would affect the state, how long investors would remember. I mean, some investors would have very short memories.
You mentioned the Washington State situation. I'm not sure really how much comfort I would take as a Washington legislator, because I would assume that that Washington will have a hard time marketing bonds for a little while.
I think that it's felt that the state of Washington and other states which are participants in the PPSS system have paid a premium in the last couple months in their debt issuances, and estimates of that have ranged from 0.5% to maybe 1.5%. Again, it's hard to say, and it's hard to say how long that will be with them, but yes, in the minds of many investors, especially individual investors who comprise a very important share of today's bond market, and individual investors probably have longer memories than institutional investors. An institutional investor is much more likely to evaluate a project on its merits, whereas an individual investor is going to pay attention to the fact that these bonds are coming from the Northwest.
Okay. Representative Ward, a question?
Yes, my original question I'm going to ask, but very quickly. My understanding is that the Seattle Port Authority still has excellent bonding capabilities, regardless of what the state of Washington may have. And so there must be some breakdown there as to where the liability stops, because of their, it's, and so it must be written different to where they're not affected by what happens with the various things within the state.
Well, again, the state's not legally obligated in any way to pay off the WHOOPS funds. So they are insulated, as is, are all jurisdictions in the state.
And then the Seattle Port Authority seems to be insulated one step farther. Okay, so what you're saying, everything falls back into obligation or something, so everything has to be paid, and if it's within the confines of the state, then we're obligated to pay it in some fashion or form. But yet throughout your presentation on your recommendations, you state that there should be no veto or no approval system by the state bond council, meaning they can't say this is a terrible thing to do, so you're not going to get your road in Kotzebue and bond the state, or you're not going to get a University of Alaska dorm or whatever it may be within our particular quasi-institute or a fish canning processing thing in Kodiak. But nevertheless, we should funnel this all through here to make it easier for our bond council, but we can't have no disapproval of it, according to your recommendation. Why are we, other than to leverage ourselves in the bond market a little bit better, where's our checks and balance? Because leveraging, from what I understand, is when things hit the free market system in the bonding capabilities, they're going to stand upon their own merit, regardless of their percentage or whether they negotiate it or not. And I don't think the front-end loading and all that really has an effect. But why would you not recommend for the state bond council to have some form of a control other than coordinating and piling up a whole bunch of reports and stuff? We already got lots of reports, and I do agree they need to be centralized, but just centralizing them, I think we may be only having to go halfway there, and I want to know your thinking on why you're suggesting we only go, in my opinion, at least for right now, possibly only halfway there, and form a centralizing gathering house, which we probably, and not probably, we do need it, but I don't think that's going to accomplish what you're talking about.
Well, I think there are two areas which the state has to address. One is issuance of debt by municipalities, and that is, I'll go into that a bit later, but I think that because there may be an ultimate political obligation to repay any bonds that are defaulted, the state should be concerned about debt that's issued. However, there are traditional local responsibilities and there are state responsibilities, and I don't believe that, it's up to the legislature, of course, to determine how much freedom is given to its localities, but I think the ability to issue debt is independent of the state, so any authority or any approval process is guarded very highly by those localities. And I think as long as they do not abuse that, that there's no need to approve all the individual debt issuances. By saying we think that the state bond committee should oversee all state-level debt issuance, oversight has a very, can mean different things to different people. To some people, it may mean approve. It may mean have the responsibility for approving. I think that's up to the legislature to decide what degree of oversight they want the state bond committee to. But I think the report recommends that oversight occur, and the way that oversight is implemented is, of course, up to individual policymakers in the state.
I could be wrong, which won't be the first time, but I thought that the state bond committee, I foresee it maybe possibly as being somewhat of a, because of lack of funding or whatever, but could be just a rubber stamp, but I thought they already had this authority to oversee if they had the proper funding to do it.
They do
so
oversee.
What are we trying to just oversee some more?
No. Yes, oversee some more. The state bond committee only has responsibility for general obligation bonds and international airport authority bonds. Those are the only bonds which it has the responsibility to pay any attention to. So what we were suggesting is that responsibility be expanded to encompass all state-level debt. And as you can see by the chart in Table 3.16, the debt that the State Bond Committee has responsibility for is only about a quarter of that issued from the state. So we were recommending that oversight responsibility be broadened to include all debt issued within the state.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sturgill.
The briefest comment, Representative Ward, I think when we look at the Alaska Railroad Authority and the Kinnick Arm Authority, as I pointed out, these are really important areas. You're suggesting possibly that the bond committee have, more responsibility of oversight, and yet the other push is, okay, let's create an agency that can go out and do it. And this is really the balance between the public authority and the ability of that authority to accomplish whatever that agency might want. So that's something I think that we have to look at in those two, as well as reviewing what its role should be to those that already exist, such as the power authority has short-term notes. There's not a default situation, but there are some serious inabilities to get power contracts, the Susitna so-called blackmail clause. There's some reasons that they may not be able to go to market, and we're going to have to come up with some money, or they're going to have to find short-term ability to turn over those particular notes. So those agencies and authorities do impact the total state, and how far do you want to go in control? I think that's part of the issue.
Yes, I agree, and that was my concern. That's why we, of course, had the Kinnick Bridge subject to law so that we could approve all authorities and all bondings, because the State Bond Committee didn't appear to be working.
Well, it didn't have the responsibility to do that. Up to now, as it presently exists, the State Bond Committee, again, only has responsibility for state general obligation bonds and international airport authority bonds. So it is not responsible for, nor should it, for other bonds that are issued by other agencies in the state. And we are recommending that responsibility be broadened.
I think that's what I think. How broad? And you can only broaden things with some form of a veto power. Otherwise, they're going to say, so what? If you don't rubber stamp it, then we're going to do it anyway.
Sort of a follow-up question with Representative Ward's inquiry about what the actual duties of the State Bond Committee would be. What's your opinion about expanding the role of the State Bond Committees, which would include the municipal level debt, and taking that into account? And how do you think that would actually save us money as far as bonding is concerned on the New York market or whatever? Is that going to really save us money if we can put it all under this one umbrella?
Well, I don't know that it'll save you any money, but it certainly will give you a much better handle on your obligations to your contingent liabilities and your direct obligations to repay debt. I'm not sure that improving debt management will be seen favorably by investors, and I believe that the knowledge that the study's been done has already, it is known by the credit rating agencies, I know, because we've talked to them about it, but I think that it's probably seen as a step in the right direction by everyone in the investment community. But I'm not sure that that's going to pay off in terms of lower interest costs. Where it does pay off is in terms of improved financial management and getting a handle on what your direct and contingent liabilities are and the ability to manage them better in the future.
Very good. Do you want to continue and we can sort of wrap things up, and then if we have any more questions. Representative Phillips, did you have a question? Very good.
I'd like to quickly touch on local government debt and a couple of recommendations that we made, steps that we think that might be taken by the state to change a few policies that are currently in existence regarding local debt. 30% of all debt that's been issued with you from the state of Alaska has been issued by municipalities. While we were writing the report, had $1.6 billion in revenue and general obligation supported debt outstanding. Now, certain borrowers in the state, certain boroughs and municipalities have very high levels of per capita debt outstanding exorbitantly high levels of debt outstanding, as you know. And we feel that the reason why certain communities have issued so much debt is largely in part of a state policy which permits localities to issue unlimited taxes to support debt service payments, but at the same time credit state property tax levies that they receive to the oil company's obligation to make payments to the state on the state terms of the state property tax. Those municipality of Valdez and the North Slope Borough, which have significant amounts of oil production property within their jurisdiction, are two of the major, two of the very heavy issuers of general obligation debt in the state. And it appears that the reason they've been able to do that is because the state is being shortchanged by those municipalities. And in effect, the state is paying the debt service on those bonds because these municipalities, the Exxon and the different oil companies, credit their state property tax obligation with their local property tax obligation. And Exxon is being taxed, but the state's not getting the money. The municipality that's issuing the debt is getting the money. There is a tax limit on municipalities for general purposes. However, the taxing ability of a municipality is unlimited to pay debt service, and that's necessary. We're not recommending that be changed. In order to sell general obligation bonds, a jurisdiction must have a limited ability to levy taxes to pay those, to meet the obligation on those bonds. Good example is the state of California, where property tax limitation included the payment of debt service within the limitations, so that, in effect, those municipalities cannot issue general obligation bonds. What we are recommending is that a ceiling or a cap on the absolute amount of debt that can be issued by any municipal jurisdiction be imposed, because we feel that it may be abused by certain jurisdictions that have this ability to levy the tax on oil production property.
Very good. Senator Strzelczewski, a brief question?
Just want to say on that one time, the North Slope Borough has debt outstanding approximately what the state of Alaska is. And just think about, $187 million in debt service. I don't think theirs is quite that high. I hope you're going to touch on us, Wes, because it's so vitally important, that debt capacity formula. I think that's an issue that will be before the legislature next year. And I don't want to take you away, but somewhere that needs to come, and this 5% is a very important concept.
Okay. I think the other, I'll comment on that now. One of the major parts of our study was to develop a criteria for assessing the debt capacity of the state. And as I mentioned earlier, it's very difficult in the case of Alaska, because all the traditional measures that are used by most investors and credit analysts in evaluating creditworthiness and ability to pay debt do not pertain to Alaska. population is not a significant resource, personal income is not a resource, property is not a resource. What is the resource is the natural resource of petroleum up in the North, largely in the North Sea. So the state's debt capacity is going to be determined, as long as that, as the state wishes to issue large amounts of debt, the debt capacity is going to be determined on the revenues that can be generated by that oil production property. If the state loses that source of revenue, its tax base is so narrow that it is unlikely that it would be able to support the debt issuance that it has, and without the imposition of quite large revenue-producing taxes. And what we recommended, therefore, is that the state determine its debt capacity as based on a fixed percentage of revenues being committed to the payment of debt service, to look at the state's that takes best advantage of the natural resource base of the state generating the revenue, because debt capacity should be determined by your ability to pay debt service and to pay off that debt, which is based upon your revenues. Your revenues are based upon the taxes you can get from the North Slope. So assessment of debt capacity requires looking into the future revenue streams of the state. And those are going to fluctuate, of course, with oil prices, and it makes estimation difficult. But we've come out in the study suggesting that a fixed percentage of revenues be set as the maximum limit that the state is going to commit in any one year to the payment of debt service. And traditionally, that ratio has been as high as 11. In the recent history, it's been as high as 11%. Right now, it's closer to 5 or 6%, depending upon the revenue, what revenue projections are used by the Department of Revenue. We feel that the 5% ratio, where the state currently is a comfortable ratio. That it's been accepted by the rating agencies, by investors, and the state has maintained that ratio for the last several years and has shown that it's able to commit that large an amount of debt service to revenues. It's also approximately what we find in the rest of the country. We use that as a basis for assessing the state's base debt capacity. And on using that measurement, we came up over the next 10 years with a capacity of approximately $252 million based on the 5% level. Now, that 5% level is not an absolute number. It's a policy decision that the legislature and the state executive branch have to make. The state is going to be able to borrow at higher levels than that. It may pay some cost in terms of higher interest rates as the amount of borrowing grows. It may also have its credit downgraded a notch or a half a notch or by the credit rating agencies as that percentage of revenues increases above 5%. In the report, we used 10% as a maximum. We thought that 10% clearly was committing a major portion of the state's budget to the payment of debt service. It requires a political decision on the part of the legislature to commit that much revenues to the payment of debt service, because once you issue debt, you're committed to repay that debt over the 20 years by contract with the bondholders. That's not an item in your budget which is subject to increase or decrease in the appropriations process. It's there, and you're not going to be able to fiddle with it. So that's one reason that's very important to set a criteria, a fixed percentage, to as a basis for assessing debt capacity. It also helps in debt management. It's very useful in capital planning. One recommendation that we make in the report is that the state include within its capital planning process a capital financing plan. Now that is something that's done in several states, and that means looking at your capital needs are going to be for the next 5 years, but coming up with a comprehensive way of meeting those financing needs through a capital financing plan, through a combination of current revenue financing, debt financing, maybe other sources of financing, federal funds, but in a coherent package, and that will improve your creditworthiness in the eyes of the investment community, because they'll know what you're planning to issue in the future. But it also helps you in terms of your financial management, how you're going to meet your capital budget needs. So using the kind of criteria that we... purposes. And we 5% is a base, 10% is probably the maximum. And within there, there's a lot of freedom because your revenues are so at such a high level.
Good question. Do you want to sort of, are there any questions from the committee people? Representative Wente, any questions at this time?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Strzelczyk.
There's one other area you didn't touch on. It's a tremendously important one. It's one you're going to be faced with. There are now two suits, as you know, one the Kenai Peninsula Borough, one the Matanuska-Susitna Borough, on the constitutional issue of funding for schools. One of the things that we found that many of the municipalities are, in a sense, under the various repayment formulas, going out with bonding, paying more for their bonds, in a sense, than because they are going back to be repaid for a portion of that, previously 90%, now down to 50%. The state, in fact, is paying for our inefficiency of using our credit resources for bonding, and it's something that Wes has brought up, and I think it's an issue now. It was my understanding from the Commissioner of Revenue, and perhaps I'm incorrect, that that was an area that he was going to be looking at that might be something your committee would like to pursue. That came up at the earlier budget and audit meeting. It's one that's going to be before us. We're going to have to deal with that question of equity and financing for schools, and it's a big one.
I'm glad the state's addressing that. Senator Strzelczyk is correct that that was the second point that we wanted to comment on, that we do comment on in the report, regarding the state and local debt. The state is, localities which are rated at lower levels than the state and therefore pay higher borrowing costs than the state are reimbursed for their debt service payments by the state. So to a certain percentage of debt service, and that has been fluctuating over the last few years, but the bottom line is that the state is paying more than it really should be. There are a variety of ways for handling that, and we suggest several alternatives. One would be to expand the use of the Municipal Bond Bank, which is a very good institution for helping localities borrow funds. It's another recommendation we make in the report is that the use of the bond bank should be encouraged and expanded by localities because it does represent real savings to them, and it is a very good institution, and it does provide a lot of support to municipalities, and it's a very positive force in helping local governments cope with financial stress. Representative Ewling, have covered major points that I intended to, so.
Okay, very good. We're just about on schedule. Representative Phillips, did you have a question?
Yeah. You stated earlier that, you know, speaking of AA rating, and I thought that occurred with you also talked about just a few minutes ago degrading of your bond rating under certain conditions. Now, I want to go over the reverse. What should the state or could the state do to upgrade from a double A to a triple A? What options do we have? Well, I'll just leave it there.
Well, the triple A rating is a very special rating. It's only reserved for very special states. I of course cannot. There are steps, of course, which you can take to try to attain a AAA rating. I think right now, however, the state should be concerned more with taking steps to ensure that it protects its AA rating. Not that it's in any danger of dropping. That's not. I don't mean to imply that at all. However, I think that a AA is very good, and you should be proud of the AA and try to keep it. Certainly you can take steps to try to get a AAA, but it's going to be very difficult. And it might not be worth the cost.
Can I ask a follow-up question?
Yeah, a quick follow-up question.
State of Oregon has a AAA rating. How do they obtain that rating?
I don't know.
Representative Flood, I want to recognize him. He's in the back. I don't know if he had a question. Do you have a question, Representative? No questions from the back. Any other questions? I guess we're going to continue again this afternoon at 1:30, and I hope that you didn't keep everybody too long. I think we got a lot of good interplay here, and we'll start again at 1:30.
Thank you.
Thank you. 1983. And for the record, we have Representative Furness, Representative Kopanen, myself, Representative Phillips, Representative Flood here. And we also have a representative for Representative Wente and Ketchikan on our teleconference so that we can keep in touch. We are going to take some public testimony at the end, so we're going to use the microphone up here because it is being taped in a couple locations, so we'll have to go to the front here if anybody wants to comment later on. First person before us this afternoon is Perry Davis with the Municipal Bond Bank, and then we'll go to Terry Elder with the Commerce and Economic Development. So, Perry, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Ewing, and members of the Legislative Committee, and other guests. I have been asked to comment on the various recommendations that the report that would affect and involve the bond bank. First, let me remind you that the bond bank's sole purpose is to serve the local municipalities. We do that by providing funds for capital improvements at terms and rates that are not burdensome for them. With regard to providing greater financial assistance to local governments, the report states specifically, a reasonable compromise between encumbering the state's debt capacity and providing greater financial assistance to local governments would be to expand the role of the bond bank. The report further states, the state should review the present security structure behind the bond bank with a view toward improving market reception by taking advantage of the state's high creditworthiness. An excellent example of this is the school debt that we talked about briefly this morning. Basically, all school debt in the past has been funded through bond ratings of A or below, while the substantial part of the debt service for school debt is from the state, which has a rating of AA. If the state would choose to require that all school debt be funded through the bond bank, and further, if the state would guarantee that portion of their debt service requirement, we would at least save the interest differential on that portion of that debt service. We concur with the recommendation that local governments make better and more use of the bond bank, and that the state review the present security structure behind the bond bank with the view toward improving market reception by taking advantage of the state's high creditworthiness. If there is any questions as we go along, please feel free to interrupt. I'll try to answer them. Again, the report states that the market performance of the bond bank is not what it ought to be, and it specifically states the Alaska bond bank issues carry yields that were on average 70 basis points higher for five-year bonds and 74.5 basis points higher for 10-year bonds than that money market yields for like-rated bonds were yielding. The report goes on to state that the discrepancy between the market reception of other bond bank bonds and that of Alaska's bonds is most likely the result of investor unfamiliarity with the Alaska Bank. This comparison indicates that the bank has the potential for saving as much as 50 basis points by undertaking an active national marketing effort. We neither accept nor reject this conclusion. However, the bank plans to change its next official statement, which will address some of the marketing problems that were pointed out in the report. The report further states the state has demonstrated its concern over local borrowing costs by creating and administering the municipal bond bank. The bond bank helps lesser known municipalities borrow at lower interest costs and issuance costs than they could achieve on their own through the pooling of several smaller issues and going with a larger issue to the market. Therefore, this report states, a state policy to encourage wider use of the bond bank by local government units should result in lower aggregate borrowing costs. There are several steps, there are several steps the state could take to improve the market performance of the bond bank. The first recommendation, the state undertake an active promotional effort aimed at potential investors. Two, the state restructure the security behind the bond bank to include stronger moral obligation pledge or a pledge of the assets of the full faith and credit of the state. The strengthening of the security could be selective, applying only to bonds for certain purposes, or it could be all-inclusive, supporting all bond issues of the bond bank. We concur with this recommendation. We also concur with the following recommendations made by the report. The adoption of the true interest cost method of calculating interest as compared to the net interest cost method. The bond bank has adopted that procedure. That all refunding issues are reviewed by the State Bond Bank Committee. To summarize, we basically concur with the recommendations of the report and, of course, look forward to the expanded role, if it happens, of the bond bank. We do need the support of the legislature with regard to increased capacity and with increased capital reserves. During the past year, the bond bank had to cut back on several issues because we did not have the capacity to issue certain municipality issues. So that is has been a critical problem for the bond bank in the past. During the current year, the governor included in his capital budget $3 million for reserves for the bond bank. He was short in his total capital budget to fund the programs he wanted to fund. The $3 million that had been allocated in his capital budget was further curtailed back to $1.8 million for our current fiscal year.
Thank you, Perry. I have a couple questions, and I'm going to go back to other representatives here. I know we made some changes in the statute last year, beginning of this year, which actually increased the capacity in the million-dollar level. I think it was $50 million that was increased. Is that correct? That we
increased $250 million.
We increased it from $150 million to $200 million.
So that was about a $50 million increase.
Correct.
What would you see from your standpoint in any kind of a change in the statutes which would actually allow the municipal bond bank to expand, but under the perspective that we could save money, particularly in regard to the local school construction financing, is there a possibility of using your bond bank as an umbrella to be able to do that, and would we save the state of Alaska a lot more money in doing so?
To answer your question, we would have to have substantial increased capacity in the bond bank. We have capacity now of about $50 million, which would run us through the current fiscal year and into fiscal 1985, allow us to plan for part of fiscal 85 based on the things that we foresee in the immediate future. Therefore, we would need substantial increase in capacity to allow us to include the school funding in our program. Also, we would need the reserves to support whatever funds would be needed for the school bond issues. But we do have the ability to do it if we have the capacity and the reserves.
Are we actually, is there a cost saving that we can occur if we do some restructuring within the school debt situation, in your opinion, or is that out of your expertise?
No, I believe that there is some savings that can be generated by going through the bond bank if we could, in fact, get the state to guarantee its portion of the debt service that it is now currently responsible for. Bonds are being sold with a rating of A, and the state is reimbursing that debt service with a rating of a double A. So we have the interest differential between an A and a double A, the savings on that, which could be a half a percentage point or more.
Very good. Questions from the panel, from the committee. Representative Furness.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Davis, I appreciate your comments so far. You mentioned the school bond indebtedness program. What responsibility of what oversight does the bonding, your program, do now concerning school bonding indebtedness, if any?
Basically, we are a reactionary bank. That is, that the school boards in a local area would demand the needs for expansion of their school. They would come to the bond bank and ask if we would assist in their funding, which, of course, we would do and we have done. I've forgotten the last part of your question.
Yeah, that was part of the question. Mr. Chairman, if I may
surely
proceed. One of the recommendations that you pursued is an active promotional effort on behalf of the bond bank, I would assume, to identify and attract additional investors. To what degree are you doing that now under your present authority?
We have a group of investors, institutional mostly, that we sell our bonds to that may be limited in scope and basically certain markets. We advise them annually of our financial condition. We send them annual reports. We send them updated official statements to keep them apprised of what's going on with the bond bank portfolio. We currently have about 150 million of bonds outstanding, approximately 40 different issues. We've never had a default. We never had a delinquency. So the bond bank is well accepted in the investment community, although there is the interest differential that was pointed out in the report of our bond bank trading 50 basis points lower than other bond banks. Now, we don't attribute the reasons for that of being strictly a credit situation. It may be because of the outlying areas that we are servicing, the Unalaskas, the Nomes, and that type of thing that may generate some of that different interest spread.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just follow with one additional question.
Sure.
There's been some conversation earlier, I think you remarked concerning it, of using the bond bank as a state coordinating entity to at least make some recommendation on an annual basis of the status of the bonded indebtedness, not only that the state of Alaska has incurred, but the various municipalities. How do you see your role in doing this, particularly when we look at the North Slope and look at Valdez as having a very substantial debt in relationship to its asset value?
I believe that the bond bank could serve a very limited role in that type of a function. I don't believe it has that idea or that goal for it to operate in those areas. The staff of the bond bank, of course, could serve on a state bond bank committee and certainly give it the input that the bond bank had, but not as a bond bank itself.
And you mentioned state bond bank committee. Do we have such an entity at this time?
Yes, we do.
Okay. I'm sorry, yeah, you're right, we do. In fact, that's the committee that some of the commissioners are currently sitting on?
That's
in addition to your board?
I don't think that any of my board is on that commission. There may be, but I'm not.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions from the committee members at this time? Thank you. Thank you very much. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. I'm Terry Elder, Deputy Commissioner of Commerce and Economic Development. And I'd just like to make a few brief comments and then would be happy to receive any questions. First of all, I think Senator Sturgulewski is to be commended for her efforts in looking at bonded indebtedness for the state when she was with LBNA and this work was commissioned. I would also agree with her that Margaret Waring is to be commended for her work when she was with Senator Sturgiolowski. And then finally, but not lastly, of course, your committee is to be commended for bringing this to a higher level of investigation rather than having it just another report that sits on the shelf and gathers dust. Bonded indebtedness is extremely important for a number of reasons. And first of all, it's a legitimate tool for all of us to use to achieve some of the goals and objectives of what we as appointed or elected representatives of the people seek to achieve for the people. But also it carries grave responsibilities because of the repercussions of doing the wrong thing, and which in the final analysis means default and higher interest rates and drains on the on public funds. And we've had, over the past legislative session, a lot of discussions and different issues that have really related to a lot of the issues covered in this report, such as the moral obligation and what's a state debt and what isn't a state debt. And I think these are extremely important issues for the people to understand that bonds are money. Bonds are state money just as appropriations are. And if you there's no free lunch. So if you pay something with bonds, somebody has to pay them back. And if they're revenue bonds, for example, certainly it's expected and anticipated that most times the revenues of a project will in fact pay for the bonds. But you have to ask yourself when you go into it, what happens if something goes wrong? And you have to be prepared so that everybody understands going into it exactly who will pay the ultimate bill if one needs to be paid. So I think it's a very important subject, and I commend all of you for looking into it. The administration at this point is utilizing this report internally to look at some of its own operations. It has not taken a position on the recommendations that are in the report at this time. There is still active discussion within the administration on the issues. Some of them, however, have been implemented. Perry just mentioned that the true interest cost method has been adopted by the Municipal Bond Bank. That's also used by the State Bond Committee, and so an issue such as that has already been adopted. But some of the other issues related specifically to the State Bond Committee, such as expanding its role in terms of oversight, expanding its membership, etc. These are all issues which are under consideration, but at this time we neither accept nor reject any of the recommendations. If you have any specific questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Yeah, possibly for the clarification of the audience, and you are here representing the State Bond Committee, is that correct?
That's correct.
As Deputy Commissioner, but also for Commissioner Lyon, and maybe if that's clarified. You know, we talked about some of the recommendations in the report this morning. What do you see as far as your expansion of your area? You aren't making any kind of moves in that area, but what if you really had to make a move, and how you could really see it streamline the bond committee itself, and how we can see a better coordination statewide with all these bonding projects? Do you think we're in for a real devastating situation in the next couple of years because we've got all these entities out there that are bonding, and how can we come to grips with it and sort of bring it together?
That's a big question. No, I don't think we're in for devastation in the next couple of years. But a lot can be done without any legislation and without expanding the State Bond Committee. Currently, the State Bond Committee consists of the commissioners of Administration, Commerce and Economic Development, and Revenue. So it's only the three commissioners. There's no staff to the State Bond Committee. The staff is really internal. So it's whatever the staff to those commissioners are. Most of the day-to-day work has been done by staff members in the Department of Revenue, in fact. A lot can be done in terms of information gathering, record keeping, that sort of thing. If the administration were to decide, in fact, to accept the recommendations of the report to be a central gatherer of information and a collector of say, bonding plans of various agencies or even municipalities. and could be a central repository of information that may have a cost involved in terms of an operating cost if you'd have to house it in some department, whether it's revenue or commerce, and unless that department had enough slack in terms of personnel, et cetera, there may be some cost involved. But if the legislature and the executive branch both agree that the benefits of doing that justify the cost, then I would think that's not an insurmountable problem. In terms of a couple of questions, I think that Representative Ward had this morning in terms of rubber stamp and where's the checks and balances. I think what I'd point out in terms of what the State Bond Committee is, the checks and balances are in the process which approves bonds and brings them to the State Bond Committee for consideration. The State Bond Committee main area of responsibility is for the timing of the bond issue, and these are direct issues. There's only been, in my experience in this past year, it's only been one time when we have asked an agency to redo the structure of its bonds, and that was Alaska Housing Finance, which simply had a different maturity structure that hadn't been run through its board of directors originally. And so we simply asked them to run that through the board of directors and then come back to us. But so there's where the checks and balances are. The legislature authorizes issuing of bonds for good and valid purposes. The boards of directors, which are largely made up of commissioners as well as public members, approve bonds, and then they're brought to the State Bond Committee. And so I think it would be very difficult to imagine that the legislature has agreed to issue bonds, and the governor has signed off on that, and perhaps has even been an election, say in the case of general obligation bonds. It would be very difficult for me to understand how then the State Bond Committee, after having gone through all those procedures, the State Bond Committee itself would unilaterally decide that they shouldn't be done.
Do we have any questions from the committee members at this time? Thank you very much. Why don't we? Do we have a problem? Okay, we've got a. We'll just take a few minute break here, and then maybe we have to set some kind of a mic up or something.
Sure.
Just a second. Before us, we have. And I might make sure that I pronounce everybody's name correctly, John Donovan and Wasalman Brothers, lead underwriter for AHFC. We have Bob Walsh, financial advisor to AHFC by Eastman Payne Weber, is that correct?
Blythe Eastman Payne Weber.
I'm sorry. John Moore, who's with Foster and Marshall, that's an easy one, I guess I can say that. And he's a financial advisor to the State Bond Committee and the Municipal Bond Bank.
That's correct.
So I know that you kind of didn't have anything that's really prepared. Would you like to say a few words about the kind of things and the basics that you're doing and where we're going with some of the bond issues? It's up to you. Any one of you who would like to start could go ahead.
Well, first of all, just to lead off, we have examined the report prepared by Mr. Huff and have found it to be very comprehensive and very helpful. There are a few points that we are probably not in total disagreement or agreement with, but we laud the effort and think that it's very comprehensive, and I think it's a very useful tool for the legislature to look at, as well as other policymakers within the state. I would be happy to address any questions that you may have that I'm qualified to speak on regarding the study.
Okay, very good. And we'll just go ahead in a round table discussion.
Yeah. While this is John Donovan from Solomon. We have reviewed the report, and I think it would be best if, from what the committee, to ask questions. We've talked over, the three of us, a number of questions and situations, and I think instead of giving a statement,
sure,
and any question at all that we're qualified to answer, we'd be very happy to answer it.
I share the same thing as John.
Okay, very good. Maybe you could give us an idea of what you characterize the state's overall financial picture at this time. are we really having any kind of a slip in our AA rating? How are we viewed at on the national level, and where are we going? Are we still looking pretty good? Are we slipping, or where are we going?
Let me answer that. I'm John Moore. We just sold acting capacity as financial advisor to the bond committee. The bond committee issued $78 million of 10-year general obligation bonds about 3 weeks ago. Prior to that sale, we went back to the rating agencies to obtain ratings. The rating agencies reaffirmed the existing ratings, which are AA from Moody's Investor Service and AA minus from Standard & Poor's Corporation. On the set date, we opened bids and obtained what we feel to be an excellent interest rate. These were serial bonds that went out 10 years, and the overall true interest cost submitted by the winning bidder was a 7.47%. We feel that was an extremely good, aggressive bid, and I think it speaks well for the state. That is as good a rate as any AA state in the nation is going to obtain.
Yes, if you'd like to comment.
I would just say one comment on that. We were the one of the managers of that bid, and John is right. It was a very good bid, and in our opinion, the state is a good, strong AA bond.
Do we have any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Furness has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This morning in the discussion, there was some mentioning of the fact that Alaska had no personal income tax, and that in some respect may cause some concern in the bonding market. You gentlemen, since you're there, you're the actual providers of that particular services. How do you see, again, the fact that we have no state income tax, the fact that we have indeed returned monies back through the permanent fund dividend program? How does those kinds of things affect us on a national level?
Well, I can speak for the actual presentation to the rating agencies, which does speak for, quote, part of the bond market, and that is they raise no concerns or ask no questions concerning the lack of a personal income tax. I think it was pointed out in the study that investors very much look to the oil revenues derived from Prudhoe Bay in deriving at investment decisions. And I do not see the lack of a personal income tax at this time as a significant matter in the eyes of investors.
I would share John's view. The rating agencies aren't concerned. I don't think the investors are concerned that the state doesn't have an income tax. As I said, they view you as a strong AA, that they have the means of supporting your debt, and that doesn't mean that you have to have an income tax to do it.
Mr. Chairman, follow up on one additional question.
Representative Furness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was another comment this morning concerning the reliance upon the permanent fund as a source of reserves, and if you consider the probability that in the near future, perhaps 10 to 15 years, we may not indeed have a healthy stream of income coming from oil revenues. How does the permanent fund as an asset sitting there affect your ability, and what do we look at in the future? Surely, as the revenues from the state decline and there becomes a need to tap into the assets of the permanent fund, things are going to change somewhat. But what do you predict now and project down 5 years, perhaps 10 years down the road, and you know the state's ability?
Well, it's explicitly clear in the offering circular, the official statement for the state's $78 million issue, that investors do not have any claim on the revenues within the permanent fund. It's I think very well known within the investment community that the state cannot pledge that money to debt service on these bonds. They recognize that. However, it does provide, in our opinion, a great deal of comfort to them, knowing that there is that amount of money sitting there. But I think it's disclosed several places that investors cannot get their hands on that money.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We have any questions from the right side? Not exactly that way, but Representative Copeland, I believe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been looking at the listing of the different AAA states, AA and A states, and we've been trying over here to figure out the criteria on which those bond assignments are made. I mean, what sort of alchemy goes into the decision?
Well, there's a host of credit considerations. They can probably be broken down maybe into four categories of a financial standpoint, of an economic standpoint, of a cash management standpoint. In other words, rating agencies and investors do not focus on one particular aspect. I mean, they're definitely going to take in all considerations in deriving at their assigned ratings. And I don't know if there's any one specific attribute that is going to guarantee a AAA rating. There are several attributes that go into that.
Now, we've just been looking at, for example, Georgia and South Carolina, Tennessee are AAA states. One can understand Utah, given the Mormon penchant for saving, and Texas with its oil. But some of the others, as an individual investor, I'd be more prone to invest in some of the AA states than in some of the ones that are AAA.
Ratings change frequently. It was brought out this morning that Oregon was a AAA and they're now a AA. My home state of Washington was a AA and they're an A rated now. So these things change rapidly.
Further question?
Absolutely, Representative Kopman.
Is there a significant market within Alaska for Alaskan bonds? In other words, just that way. To what extent would you feel, since you gentlemen are in the private bond market, are issues bought by investors with discretionary funds in Alaska?
I can cite one example. I can't speak for the sales performance on this last issue because I haven't seen the statistics of how many were sold within the state. I am aware of the municipality of Anchorage issuing telephone revenue bonds earlier this summer. Was structured on such a basis to really penetrate the local market. And the outcome of that, I think, was very favorable, that there was quite a bit of participation within the state.
Thank you. I think that's significant because we have a very thin market. We don't have that many people with that much money. But I think it would be also an important point in the confidence aspect, that is, if people are willing to invest in their state, well, you're more certain that they're going to be trying to make sure that they get paid.